Sue Fraser, and on behalf of the Press Club Committee, I wish to acknowledge our sponsors, as always. Welcome to representatives of Optus Communications, and we thank them for their support. Also to Qantas for flying in our guest speaker at no cost to the Press Club. To Optus Communications and to Qantas, our sincere appreciation. Thanks also to representatives... Yes, you may clap them. Thanks also to Southcourt Wines, who have joined us today. I'd also like to take this opportunity to mention that the Press Club Committee comprises the following 10 people, just so you know who is behind the scenes of the Press Club. Don Riddell, President, John Doherty, Jim Mattock, Robert Main, David Heath, Rex Jory, Mike Pilkington, Chris Willis, Judith Bleachmore and myself, with Tony O'Brien as our function coordinator. Suggestions and mailing list queries can be directed to any one of us. Now, on your table, we have $2 raffle tickets to keep us in the black. You could win today a $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Googie Street, which is seafood heaven. Thank you very much to Alan Rogers. $50 voucher also to Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street, Italian Bliss, also thanks to Alan Rogers, two great little restaurants there. Also, two tickets to the Royal Adelaide Wine Show, a VIP tasting on Friday the 10th of October. Friday the 10th, right, okay, at the Royal Adelaide Wine Show. Thank you, Francine Connor, for that. Really appreciate that. And you could also win a carton of Hahn Premium from SA Brewing. So just grab those $2 tickets that are on the table and we'll come around and collect them. It's now time to turn off your mobile phone, I'm sure you have, as a courtesy to our guest speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the South Australian Press Club, Don Riddell.
Thank you, Sue. Paul Kelly's just a little bit special. He's a journalist, of course, but there's more than that. It's Paul Kelly who has set out just what is the meaning of modern-style Australian politics. And there's only two or three people since Federation who can claim to have done that. For 20 years, as a political reporter with The Australian, Paul lived, brooded, dissected, and most importantly, wrote about politics. Then he went on for 5 years or so and became a boss as editor-in-chief of The Australian. And we all noted the intellectual lift this gave the paper. He's now got the best job in Australian journalism, international editor of The Australian, whatever that means. But perhaps Paul's greatest gift for us has been his four books that explain for a generation the Australian ways of doing politics. And he gave us a living phrase with a title that summed up Australia in the 80s, The End of Certainty. I don't know what Paul's going to talk about today, but the only certainty is he's going to go up and talk to us. Paul Kelly.
Thanks very much, Don. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be back in Adelaide and to address this gathering. I don't get to Adelaide these days nearly as much as I'd like to, but it's wonderful to come back and to meet some old acquaintances and some very good old friends here. I can remember first coming here a lot with Gough Whitlam, who really introduced me to Adelaide in a previous age, the early 70s. Gough used to come a lot, and we'd always stay at the old Park Royal and have a wonderful time doing all the things which guests are supposed to do when they come to Adelaide. I seem to be sandwiched between the News Corporation meeting and the state election, and I guess that's a good place for a journalist to be. So I'm here at the appropriate time. I certainly trust that I'm not here under any false pretenses. These days when people say that Paul Kelly is talking, after I arrive, I often detect a sense of disappointment that I don't have either my football or my band with me. My topic today is neither the media nor state politics. I want to focus instead on the political, constitutional and cultural process now unfolding in Australia with next February's Constitutional Convention. Make no mistake, this is going to be a remarkable event. This event will start to get genuinely serious news coverage, probably from tomorrow, when we see the list of nominees for election to the convention. And I think all of us would be aware of the incredible emotional impact on this country and other countries with the death of Princess Diana. And tied up in that death and its aftermath was very much feelings about the monarchy. In some ways, I think it's far too early to say what the political and constitutional significance of Diana's death is for the monarchy in Britain. But I venture to suggest that one of the consequences is we may have what one could call now a conditional monarchy. The monarchy survives providing it retains a degree of explicit consent and popularity from the British people. And if so, that I think is a very, very important and interesting event. My argument today is that decision-making time for the Australian Republic is not far away. And indeed, the Republic itself might not be too far distant. My belief is that the debate about the Republic can help the process of national renewal. And my message is that this is a participatory event. It's a chance for all Australians to get involved and take a decision about their own country. And so it's a decision which is important. I think that if one focuses on the mood in Britain after Diana's death, one can see that this is not just a question about politics, it is an emotional decision about how one feels about one's country. I always believed that having a coalition government in Canberra and in most of the states would not derail the debate about the Republic. It would change that debate and it would change the atmospherics. There's no doubt at all about that. It would mean that the Republic would need a different approach. But there were always advantages for Republicans and advantages in the Republican debate in having coalition governments in power. There's one really important point about the Republic. A party political majority is not good enough to carry it. It's not like winning an election. There's no way the ALP vote can achieve a republic. To win a Republican referendum, there must be cross-party support. A majority of votes in a majority of states. So you need support both across the existing parties and a broad sentiment within the electorate. Let me repeat. You need support across the existing parties and a broad sentiment of backing in the electorate. I suggest we're about to see in this country the most significant collaboration across party lines that we've seen conceivably since the war. Republican tickets will be broadly based with representatives on those tickets from Liberal, Labor, Democrats, National Party, young, old, women, men, ethnics, Aboriginals and Anglo-Celtic Australians. And I'm sure the monarchist ticket will similarly aim for a very broad base. It's novel. It's going to be a shock for us. But I think this is a great thing. What we're going to see during this upcoming election is Labor organisers handing out how-to-vote cards for Republican tickets which contain well-known Liberals. I think there should be as much crossing the party boundaries as possible. It's not really clear yet how prevalent this will be, but to me, this process of crossing the boundaries, destroying some of the old mindsets, is absolutely fundamental in creating the ethos, in creating the right environment, in creating the conditions for a broad alliance of inclusion, for a spirit of bipartisanship, which is absolutely essential if Australia is going to make this leap to a republic. And if we don't create this spirit, then it won't happen. As editor-in-chief of The Australian from 1991 to 1996, I positioned the paper so we were very much a pro-Republican paper. And I did that not just for narrow Republican grounds, I did it because I believed that the transition to the Republic can be the cause for releasing a lot of creative juices. It can do more than simply create a Republic. It can force us to think more about our national direction. It can help to renew the country. It's very important that while this will be a major debate and there will be tensions and there will be disputes and there will be a lot of vigour and aggressiveness, as there always is when Australians conduct these sorts of political debates, it's very important, though, at the end of the day, that this ultimately be a process that unites the country, that gives the country a lot more confidence, that makes us feel happier about ourselves. And I sense at the moment that we don't feel happy about ourselves. There's a sense of, it's a dichotomy, apathy and agitation. I don't exaggerate what the Republic can do. I think it's a mistake to exaggerate what the Republic can do. The Republic is not the answer to all sorts of our national problems, and anyone who says it is being foolish. But on the other hand, it's very silly to downgrade the issue altogether and say it's not important. It's irrelevant. That's wrong. So we should see the issue in context. We should see it in perspective, as one among many important issues facing the country. Now, this Constitutional Convention is going to be a major event. It was proposed by the Liberal Party, but its real genesis, of course, lies in Paul Keating's Prime Ministership. Let's think back about what Keating did on this issue. In his 1993 policy speech, Keating sought a mandate to pursue the cause of an Australian Republic with the intention to put a referendum to secure a Republic by the centenary of Federation in 2001. After the 1993 election, Keating commissioned a constitutional blueprint by a distinguished committee headed by Malcolm Turnbull. In a meeting with the Queen of Balmoral, Keating advised the Crown formally that Australia would move down the path towards a Republic within the Commonwealth. The Queen accepted the process outlined by her Prime Minister, and the Prince of Wales, when he subsequently visited this country, endorsed the debate and said that the debate about the Republic in this country was the sign of a healthy democracy and a sign of national maturity. Before the 1996 election, Paul Keating outlined a preferred Republican model in which the office of Governor-General would convert into a non-executive presidency elected by the Parliament and governed by the same conventions of impartiality that relate to the office of Governor-General. In his speech, a speech which Sir Zelman Cowan has recently quoted, Keating said, "The creation of an Australian Republic can actually deliver a heightened sense of unity. It can enliven our national spirit and in our own minds and those of our neighbours, answer beyond doubt the perennial question of Australian identity, the question of what we are and what we stand for." I can fault Keating, unusually, on only one issue. I believe that he should have had Sir William Dean as Governor-General elected to the post in a joint sitting, thereby inaugurating, possibly, with our last Governor-General the process he intended to apply for the election of an Australian President. In this fashion, we would be halfway there now. The Liberal Party, in a decision of intelligent adaption and to minimise its internal divisions, proposed before the last election a convention. And John Howard kept his promise. The convention will meet for 10 days in February next year in the old Parliament House, Canberra. Half the delegates are appointed and half elected. Of the 76 appointed delegates, 40 are from federal and state parliaments, including the Premier and opposition leader from all parliaments. The other 36 appointed delegates are broadly based and have been nominated by the Howard government and announced already. The 76 elected delegates will be elected in an optional preferential voluntary postal ballot. I think it's very important that voting turnout in this ballot be substantial. Quite clearly, the higher the turnout, the more democratic legitimacy will attach to the convention, half of whose delegates are being elected. The convention itself, it's important to bear in mind, will be solely devoted to the issue of the Republic. I think that's a very important decision by John Howard. The convention is not running around the kitchen when it comes to the whole agenda of constitutional reform. It's focused on the Republic. And indeed, the convention will be directed towards three questions. Whether or not Australia should become a republic. Secondly, which republican model might be put to the electorate to consider against the status quo. And thirdly, the timetable and circumstances in which any change might be considered. In other words, the agenda for this convention is very, very focused. The convention has to come up with an answer to those three questions. Now, John Howard, in his commitments before the 1996 election, didn't just promise a convention. He went beyond that. He set in place what happens after the convention. And essentially what he said was this. He said that if the convention reached a consensus, he would put that consensus to the people in a constitutional referendum. And that if the convention did not reach a consensus, he would nonetheless seek an expression of public opinion by vote from the people before the end of the year 2000. And obviously that means a non-binding plebiscite, but it means a vote from the Australian people as to what they think of the issue. Now, this is enormously important because John Howard, his convention it is, has already outlined what happens after the convention. There is another stage. I believe that it was enormously important that this convention be proceeded with, and I'm delighted to see that the legislation not all that long ago passed the Senate on the second opportunity. Because I have to tell you, if that legislation had not passed the Senate, then I think that would have terminated the Republican process under the Howard government, under a coalition government. And I think that John Howard as Prime Minister would have had a perfectly legitimate argument not to proceed with the issue further. So I'm delighted to see that that convention is going ahead, and I note in passing that the Labor Party voted against it. I understand the difficulty of the voluntary voting system. My belief, however, is that having a system of voluntary voting for the convention does not prejudice Australia's system of compulsory voting at elections, and that it was worthwhile tolerating voluntary postal voting for the convention in order to get the convention up. That was the judgment made by Malcolm Turnbull when he was lobbying, and I think it's the correct judgment. Now, this convention is, as I said, going to be a big event, and the states will play a very important role. What will be the attitude of the Liberal premiers? Rundle, Kennett, Olson, Court. After all, we're talking here, at the end of the day, about a process of constitutional change where we know the role of the states is fundamental. We know the Labor parties in the states are committed to change, but there aren't going to be Labor premiers there, there'll be Labor opposition leaders, but there will be Liberal premiers. And my view of the Liberal premiers is that they are all very, very pragmatic on the issue of the Republic. I think they're very alive to the trend of community opinion, and I think these Liberal premiers are quite prepared to move closer to a Republican model, if not embrace a Republican model. That's why the vote will be enormously important for the elected delegates. Now, if in fact the vote for the elected delegates reflects the trend in the community, as documented by public opinion polls, which shows that essentially Republicans are running at about 50% up to 53-54%, and monarchists about a third of the vote, around about 33% of the vote, then it seems reasonable to assume that there will be a floor majority at the conventions, at the convention for the Republic. If there's a floor majority, what it means is that at the end of 10 days, the questions that the convention is asked to answer will be answered along the following lines, according to a majority vote, as distinct from a consensus. There can't be a consensus, and there won't be a consensus. But if the Republicans have a majority, the answers to the three questions will be as follows. Yes, Australia should become a republic. The model should be the minimalist model, what one might have called the Keating model, but which won't be called the Keating model at the convention. It'll be called the Cowan model. And thirdly, the timetable. I think that the recommendation in relation to the timetable will be for a referendum to be put in the term of the next federal parliament before 2001, and that clearly means before the Sydney Olympic Games. If that is the recommendation from the convention, it'll be interesting to see how many Liberals vote for that recommendation, and in particular, whether there are any Liberal premiers who vote for that recommendation. And if they don't actually vote for the recommendation, whether they put in a qualification which isn't too far away from that particular recommendation. Now, the convention, of course, is Howard's convention. And there's no doubt that John Howard will take the process to the next stage. And that means that Howard has a decision to take, and it's quite a fascinating decision in this situation. He can do one of two things. He can listen to the convention and put a referendum to the people in the year 2000 before the Sydney Olympics. Or he can stick by the letter of his pre-1996 election commitment, and he can put a plebiscite between the status quo on one hand and the Republican minimalist model on the other. My view is that John Howard should put a referendum. He should test the issue by putting a referendum to try to settle the question one way or another, and give Australians the chance to change decisively before 2001. Now, I might finish up by just looking at two things. First of all, I'd like to remind people that there are really three positions in this debate. There's the constitutional monarchy, there's the Zelman-Cowen Republic, parliamentary election of the president, which is a non-executive presidency, or there is the republican model that the people want, a popularly elected president, which will lead to a significant change in the way we are governed, because a popularly elected president will conceivably, on some issues, be more powerful than the prime minister. I think it's important that the Zelman-Cowen parliamentary election of the president model prevail. I don't think we should make radical changes to our system of government. But there is a question here, and the question is whether the Australian people might only accept a republic if they can elect president. That, at the end of the day, is the fascinating, intriguing and decisive question in this debate. I think it's very important for constitutional monarchists to conduct the debate in a constructive fashion and to bear in mind that if at the end of the day the Zelman-Cowen model is put to the people and rejected, then there is a certain logic for the Republican movement in moving to the popularly elected presidency. And that is a model, that is a Republican model, which constitutional monarchists would not want. There's no doubt the constitutional monarchists would prefer to see the minimalist republican model rather than the directly elected presidency. And finally, what will a republic give Australia? Well, I like to think it will give us a greater depth of national maturity and responsibility. It's not directed against Britain at all. An Australian Republic will continue to have excellent, if not better, relations with the mother country. The Republic is all about being pro-Australian and defining our own way in the future. Thanks very much.
He can't help himself, can he? I saw four books there. A Conditional Monarchy, Crossing the Boundaries, The Process That Unites the Countries, and the best one of all, Apathy and Agitation. To continue that apathy and agitation, Paul will now subject himself to questions from the media, and if the media runs out, then to the general public. But the ordinary conditions apply. Please state your organisation before you ask your question, and make questions, not statements. Thanks very much. Matt, you going to start?
Okay. Is that on? That's on. Seeing you no longer my editor, Paul, there's no advantage in me sucking up to you. However, I will say that when I die, and if I have a chance to come back again, I'd like to be born with your brain and Philip Adams' voice and Malcolm Turnbull's money. And I'll just predicate this question by saying that it is sucking up, but, well, you never know, what goes around comes around. But present company accepted from this room when I ask this question. I have a 17-year-old daughter, a 14-year-old son, and an 8-year-old daughter, and I have no doubt that when they're all voting age, they'll vote overwhelmingly in favour of a republic or believe in a republic. However, I'm wondering whether it's the silly old buggers who will be the stumbling block to a republic, and the only time we will get a republic is when we have a generational change and when the monarchy generation of Australians has been washed out of the system, which is a polite way of saying they've died.
I don't think we wait around for generational change. One can always have that argument on any given issue of public policy. One can always say, let's wait until we get the generational change. Let's wait for the next generation. But that goes on and on. So I guess my own, and this is a very personal feeling about this myself, Matt, my personal feeling is we get on with it. We get on with it. And I think that we should get on with it, not just in terms of the Republic, but really on a wide range of issues. I think this is very much a confidence question. And I think one of the difficulties for Australia at the moment is I think we're faltering. I think there is there's a crisis of confidence, in fact, on a whole range of issues. And I think that we need to get over that. And that requires both brains and courage, but we do need to move on.
Roy Eccleston from The Australian. Two questions, actually, Paul. One, you mentioned, I thought it was quite interesting, the idea that you would have this great crossover between the parties who are supporting one particular objective in this debate. Do you think it's possible that, as a result of this, you can have any new political alliances formed in Australia, new political parties or something coming from this which has a longer-lasting impact on national debate? And secondly, you've expressed concern about the possibility of the third option, which is the popularly elected president. Why are you concerned about that, given that people today elect an MP, goes to Canberra, we all know the executive government, that is the cabinet, rules. Why is it a bad thing? People cannot elect someone they will then see as fulfilling that agenda they have been elected on.
It's my hope we get as much crossover as possible. I don't know how much we'll get, but there may well be some Labor politicians who want to commit to the monarchy. Some closet monarchists there in the old Labor Party. But certainly we know when it comes to Liberals that we've got prominent people, Baden Teague, Sally Ann Atkinson, Bruce Baird, Nick Greiner. One can look across the states. There are a lot of Liberals or people who are closely associated with the Liberal Party who are now committed to the Republic. And I think that's a very good thing because, as I said, we've got to have the crossover to make it work. We've got to. It can't be a party political exercise. It's got to be an exercise where you break down the old boundaries and you create new alliances. Now, you ask, Roy, about the possibility for changes in the party structure. Well, it's hard to see in Australia. I think the party system is very entrenched in this country, and to a large extent it's reinforced by our voting system, which I think is a pretty good voting system. I think a politician whom I'm very interested in, Tony Blair, is however fascinating in this regard. One of the reasons I think Blair is so significant is because I think he is the first post-Labor Party politician of the 20th century. By that I mean Blair has come to office at a time when in Britain the labour market is deregulated and the unions are very weak. And essentially he is not, in his ethos, a Labour politician. He is a smaller Liberal politician. And in the speech he gave the other day, he talked about his heroes. They include Lloyd George. They include Lord Keynes. I mean, this is like Kim Beazley getting up at the Labor Party conference and talking about his heroes and finding that half of them aren't Labor politicians. And essentially what Blair is on about is, I think, at the end of the 20th century, moving more towards, in the 21st century, the sort of political model that prevailed before the rise of class politics and before the development of the industrial movement transformed politics and led to the rise of the Labor Party, because globalisation is essentially destroying the power of organised labour. And Blair's historic significance is that he's understood this. And he is therefore moving along these lines. He's very interested in forming a good relationship with the Liberal Democrats as a matter of heresy. If Labor wants a circuit breaker in Australian politics today, why not think of a Labor-Democrat alliance in the context of the 1998 election? I mean, I would have thought that Cheryl Kerner, who after all was one of the very few politicians invited to the ACTU Congress the other day and spoke to the ACTU Congress along with Kim Beazley. I mean, the Democrats are no longer the Don Chip Party, the party in the middle between Labor and Liberal. The Democrats are a faction of a Labor Party, pure and simple. And, you know, there may well be constructive advantages if Labor was prepared to break down its monopoly culture, which, of course, it won't do. Oh, that's just a fantasy. Now, Roy asked about the popularly elected presidency. The reason it's not a good thing is because it divides the executive government. And I think this is really bad. I mean, essentially, you're going to have a president with a lot of executive power and a prime minister with a lot of executive power, and they are going to compete against each other. Now, I think anyone who thinks that, you know, Australian politics is plagued by enough stories of sort of division and scandal and so on would accept the fact that the last thing in the world we need is two people trying to run the country, the Prime Minister and the President.
David Penberthy.
Thank you. David Penberthy from the Adelaide Advertiser. Well, my question follows on in some ways from the point that Matthew Abraham raised earlier. Since John Howard became Prime Minister, there seem to be some fairly strong signs that he himself is very much a part of the older generation that Matt referred to. We saw John Howard refuse to attend a charity function in Sydney because Princess Diana was going to be there and he didn't want to offend the Queen. And this year, on the day that Princess Diana died, there was some pretty strong speculation within the Canberra Press Gallery that Mr. Howard was extremely reluctant to appear to even comment about her tragic death for fear of perhaps offending the royals or elevating her status beyond that of the Queen. My question is, do you agree with the view that's held particularly strongly within sections of the Liberal Party that John Howard would be prepared to stymie any push for Australia to become a republic because he would regard the loss of the constitutional monarchy as a massive failure of his leadership?
I think it's a very important question, and I'm not exactly certain of the answer, but I suspect the answer is no. I do appreciate how deeply the Prime Minister is committed to the constitutional monarchy, and I do appreciate that he has very little sympathy with a republic. However, he is a practical politician. He has to govern the country at this point in time. He has to live with the promises he's made. He has to operate within the framework of the debate in which we have a number of Liberal state premiers indicating that they're far more pragmatic about this issue. And we should recognise that John Howard honoured his promise. He went to the last election saying he'd have a constitutional convention. He put a bill for a constitutional convention, and there is going to be a constitutional convention. And therefore, I assume that Howard will also honour the next stage of his commitment, which is to put the issue to the people, either in terms of a referendum or a plebiscite. And I think he's aware of the dangers in being seen to break those commitments. I think he's aware of the dangers in being seen to terminate the issue if he terminates the issue in such a way that he is breaking his own promises to debate the issue and manifestly only acting out of personal sentiment rather than acting in response to public opinion and the Australian tradition of democratic process and public debate. So I therefore think that the process will continue, and I also believe that there are some advantages having coalition leaders in office while this is continuing. Because if there were Labor leaders in office committed to the Republic, then there may be less chance of getting support for the Republic from the Liberal and National parties.
Bob Main of the Bulletin. Sorry, Robert Main of the Bulletin.
Thank you, President Donald. Paul, let me say that I think that what you said today is perhaps some of the most passionate words we've had at this club, and I thank you very much for it. I'm sure others will later. You obviously know Tony Blair moderately well, otherwise you would have been not dropping the name so much. Would you give us an undertaking, this is a simple yes or no, would you give us an undertaking that when it gets very cold in England and perhaps warm in this part of the world, that if Tony Blair comes back to South Australia, as you know he spent some time here in his younger days, would you drop him a note and ask him whether he'd speak to us? First part of my question.
I promise.
Thank you, okay. Our committee has discussed this. In fact, we'd love to have him here, of course, and we'd love to have you here with him. Can I speak for you, Mr. President, on that? Two other little questions. I'd like to ask you to tell us, first of all, your best anecdote about Gough Whitlam, and on a more serious vein, I'd like to ask you what you really think about Paul Keating.
Well, I could speak for the next 2 hours about Gough Whitlam, just telling Gough Whitlam anecdotes, but when I was a very junior reporter in Canberra, Gough, Labor was in opposition in those days, of course. The surge was coming, and Gough used to brief the press gallery after the weekly caucus meeting. And the ritual for the weekly caucus meeting, of course, was that the party would endorse the latest policy for the 1972 election. And I went down there one day. And the interesting thing about Gough was, no matter what the policy was, whether you were talking about the most sweeping national initiative or the most mundane grassroots issue, Gough presented every issue as being of towering significance. This particular day, the Labor caucus had endorsed the growth proposal for Albury-Wodonga, that Albury-Wodonga would develop as one of Australia's great cities. And Gough gave the briefing, and we were all terribly impressed and thought, gee, we'd better get back to Albury. You know, the last time I was in Albury, it was a sleepy little town, but obviously it's about to be transformed beyond recognition. And then one journalist said, Mr. Whitlam, what will the new city be called? And quick as a flash, Gough turned to this journalist and said, what will it be called? Whitlamabad, of course. I won't keep going. I could easily go on, but I won't. So that's my anecdote about Gough for this lunch. What do I think of Paul Keating? Well, I think that he is a great but flawed leader. I think that he was an excellent treasurer, a great politician, and a prime minister with a mixed record. Keating challenged Hawke. The argument that the Hawke people used, the length and breadth of Parliament House, was, you can't have Keating. You can't have Keating. He only knows about the economy. I mean, how on earth could you have Keating? What on earth would he say when he goes overseas? I mean, he's just economic man. He can't relate on any other issue on any other level. And, of course, when one looks at the Keating Prime Ministership, Keating, of course, the day he became Prime Minister, true to form, looked ahead as the great creative politician that he was. And essentially his Prime Ministership was about Aboriginal reconciliation and Mabo, about putting the Republic on the agenda in such a way that I think the momentum won't be lost, and in years to come we'll look back and we'll say, well, Keating was the turning point. And in relation to the Asia Pacific, he did two things. His commitment to Asia Pacific diplomatic architecture was just immense. I mean, he had very close personal relations with a number of world leaders, and he had an enormous influence in terms of really getting up the APEC agenda in a very big way. In particular, the commitment to free trade by 2010 and 2020, which you've realised will be one of the significant events in world history in the early part of the 21st century. But of course, he tried to popularise the notion domestically of Asia-Pacific engagement for Australia. He tried to popularise the idea. And it was important that an Australian Prime Minister start to do that.
He's not quite a journalist, but I think Chris Schott once wrote a reply, and I ask him, please, to put it in the form of a question.
Well actually, as a continuous member of the Australian Journalists Association for 28 years, and as a writer of this, a contributor to the Labor Herald, I now rise as a journalist to ask a question of Paul. This issue of whether the president should be elected or appointed by Parliament. I support the model, as you call the Cowan model, of appointment by two-thirds majority. One, it'll be simple. Two, it'll mean that a party hack won't get elected. You'll have to get agreement that it'll be a non-party political person. And that's why people want to have an election, so that they don't get a party hack. What they don't realise, we never brought an election. Only the two major parties can organise the whole thing of giving out how to vote cards and everything to get somebody elected. However, I think that if it came a choice for having a republic or no republic, I would live with electing a president on one condition, is that you would have to codify the powers of the president so the dispute with the prime minister did not occur. Now, and the example we have in recent history is Mary Robinson in Ireland, but before we get too carried away with that, before she was elected president, they had a range of party hacks as president, and she only got elected because the two-party hacks, once nominated after the close of nominations from the two major parties, turned out to have corruption scandals around them. And so this woman who was running third suddenly became the only one who could be elected, and therefore she changed, by definition, the nature of the position. So I think, can we live with that model if that was the only way of... But it would mean, do you accept we'd have to codify the powers that the president wouldn't be able to keep sacking the Prime Minister every second day.
Chris, was there a question in that?
About the election. The question is, can you get round the election of a president by codifying the powers of the president so he's not in conflict with the Prime Minister?
Thanks, Chris.
Well, I agree with those two points that Chris has made, and I think they're both fundamental points. The first point being that the reason people favour direct election of the president is because they think they can control that process. The great irony, of course, is that if there is direct election, the parties will control the process. And therefore, we've got the best way to secure a non-party political figure as president is to have the parliament elect the president with a two-thirds majority, which of course will guarantee that the figure has to be bipartisan. So I agree completely with that point, and I think it's a very, very important point. The second point I think is absolutely true. we do have options here. I mean, Republicans do have options. And so far, Republicans have been somewhat restrained. One could even say amazingly restrained in advocating a Republican model, which is actually grossly unpopular in terms of the two Republican models. Now, if at the end of the day, and I don't rule this out at all, it may well be that the attitude of the Australian people is that they will only have a republic if they can directly elect the president. Now, if that is the attitude, then I think that people will adapt and accept that. But that means, as Chris just says, that the powers must be codified. And this is tricky and it is complicated. But providing the powers are codified, then that is the ultimate guarantee which makes a directly elected president a satisfactory option. I would agree with that. I still think, in terms of preference, that the first model, the Keating-Zelman-Cowen model, what a bizarre alliance, is the appropriate one.
Alec Matheson, Messenger Newspapers. Only not really a journalist, but GM. If, whether it's the Cowen-Keating system or the public choice, who do you see as being an ideal president? Apart from me.
Well, my view on this is we simply continue the existing tradition. The office of Governor General has been in a state of constant evolution since 1901. What happened at the time of Federation was there was no British High Commissioner in this country. The Governor General was the representative of the British government. I mean, we were not an independent country. We were not an independent country in constitutional terms, as Sir Garfield Barwick pointed out many times, and we were not an independent country in judicial terms, and we were not an independent country in political or diplomatic terms. The Governor General was the representative of the British government, and his job was to keep an eye on what Australian Prime Ministers did. Now, today we have Bill Dean as Governor General, and the office is evolving. The Governor General is out there talking. He's making a few waves. He's talking to the community. He's doing what Ninian Stephen told me when he finished up as Governor General that he tried to do, represent the nation to itself. I think people such as Bill Dean, such as Ninian Stephen, are excellent choices. If we look at previous state governors, someone like Roden Cutler, I think, was a tremendous governor of New South Wales. Essentially, we have to look for intelligent figures who can represent the nation to itself, who've got a capacity to be able to put some important issues before the people in terms of the way they discuss issues, but who at the end of the day don't try to do a John Kerr.
I can take two more questions. Malcolm McCarris.
Current Irish presidential election, all four candidates are women. And have you noticed that the popular election in 1990 showed virtually no correlation between normal party vote and vote for president? Therefore, does it not follow that if we codified the powers and had a popular elected president using the same preferential voting system as the Irish use, we would in fact have a completely non-partisan election? And almost certainly we would finish up with the kind of president of whom we could be proud, and that this makes an enormous difference to the situation, bearing in mind that the president of a country is supposed to be the one-person distillation of the entire people. Is it not therefore the case that the arguments against the Irish model are without foundation?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting argument, Malcolm, and I'm delighted to see you putting it forward in that way. It's a very interesting case for a directly elected president. I haven't looked closely enough at Mary Robinson's election to know. I guess a lot depends upon the strength of the party system, the extent to which the party system commits to the election, and who the individuals are seeking election. I mean, there are those variables. But I'm very interested in what you say. And it may well be that the seeds are there for us to rethink somewhat in terms of the option of a directly elected president. As I say, I don't know enough about the Irish example. I suppose what people say is they say Mary Robinson's a one-off. Don't give us the Mary Robinson example because she's the exception to the rule. We've got to look at the rule, not the exception. But well, sure. I mean, I'm simply saying what is often said about that particular issue. But I think it's very interesting the point you raise.
This is the last question, I think, we have time for.
My name is Frances Bedford. I'm a member of the Media Alliance, and I'm also a candidate in the state election this weekend, so I couldn't resist the opportunity to ask you a sneaky question, which relates to privacy laws, which I guess fits in with the death of Princess Di in England recently. A fairly significant media figure this week said that we shouldn't be introducing privacy laws in Australia. So I wanted to ask you, as a key journalist in the national media, whether you ever get stories that are so hot that you have to really think about what you're going to do with them, and if there are significant breaches of the laws at the moment, and even if a story that was significantly in breach was landed on you, how you'd handle it.
Well, the situation here varies a lot from country to country. I think that's the first point to make. So, you know, what... and also the traditions between Australia, Britain and America in this area differ quite a lot. I think that's also an important point to make. I think that there's no doubt at all in the present climate that the media need to be careful and they need to be responsible in terms of the way they discharge their duties. I think that it's very important that journalists and editors have a regard for the privacy of individuals, particularly in the case of tragedy and that sort of issue. I think that the community itself is reasonably alert to the need for some degree of privacy and respect for privacy of individuals. On the other hand, I think, you know, the fundamental role of the media to investigate, to disclose, to report must remain in place.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Paul Kelly. Don't go yet. You have to take with you, with our thanks, a bottle of good Republican Red. I have a message from our secretary that says, please leave your name tags in the boxes as you go out, or it'll cost us quid to get some new ones. Thank you very much indeed for coming.